This episode is brought to you in part by the American Homebrewers Association, makers of the free Brew Guru mobile app. If you love brewing beer and saving money on beer when you go out, you need Brew Guru in your corner. The app offers a searchable database of homebrew recipes, including popular craft beer clones and hundreds of winning recipes from the National Homebrew Competition. What's more, Brew Guru has a map of money-saving deals at breweries, beer bars, and homebrew shops. Grab the free Brew Guru app for iPhone and Android devices and follow the path to good beer. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 13th, 2018. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about homebrewing. This week, Val Allen, brewmaster at Anderson Valley Brewing, talks about his new book, Goza, Brewing a Classic German Beer for the Modern Era. Val will give us some history of this tart, subtly salty style and share some tips on brewing it ourselves. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, our DVDs, our brewer's logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear, including our tie-dye silicone pint. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. And if you do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, they say that that will help new listeners to find us. And if you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing, and there you can get recipes, and you can get early releases of videos and exclusive videos and all kinds of stuff. And if you're a financial subscriber to Basic Brewing already, be sure to check your inbox for an early release of the Basic Brewing video that will be posted to the general public on Friday. This one featuring my Instant Pot version of Ed Nicholson's Habanero Hot Sauce. My habanero plant is still going strong, so I'm going to keep on making more hot sauce. It gives me when life gives you peppers, you make hot sauce. And last night, I used some red jalapeno glaze that Steve gave me on some baby back ribs that I cooked in my Instant Pot, too. So it's getting spicy around here. I went to the store yesterday and picked up a family-sized box of Monster Cereal Blueberry. It's blueberry-flavored, I guess, or something similar. In the past, I've brewed a Frankenberry Weiss and a Count Chocula Milk Stout for our Halloween show. But this is the first time that I've come in contact with Booberry, and the first time I'll be brewing a Booberry beer. I have an idea of what I want to do, but I don't want to spoil it now by announcing it yet. The family-sized box is a little over a pound, and I'm thinking about a 2-gallon batch. So maybe we'll actually, you know, get some influence of the quote-unquote flavoring from the Booberry. So stay tuned for details. Let's hear about our sponsor, Imperial Organic Yeast. Imperial offers the highest cell count of any liquid yeast producer at 200 billion cells. Proper pitch rates are easy to hit, making starters virtually unnecessary for 5-gallon batches of standard gravity wort. As I say, my stir plate is dusty. My Erlenmeyer flasks look at me longingly from the shelf because I don't use them anymore. I used to feel the need to make a starter for every batch brewed with liquid yeast, but batches brewed with Imperial take off in short order without a starter. Imperial is the only manufacturer of organic liquid yeast in the world, and they have an industry-leading QC program with top-notch customer service. If you call Imperial, an actual human will answer and take your questions. Imagine that. Imperial organic yeast used to come in the little cans, but now they have big, easy-to-open pouches that make pitching a breeze. Check out their website, imperialyeast.com, for the long list of yeast strains that they offer. And Casey from Imperial says that they are a completely open lab, so anytime you're in Portland, feel free to drop by and take a tour. Might want to call first to make sure that they... but check them out. We met up with the Imperial people up there in Portland, and they're great folks. Their product is awesome. Steve's Brew Shop and High Gravity both now stock Imperial Organic Yeast. So you'll love them too. Check out Imperial Yeast at imperialyeast.com. Imperial Organic Yeast. imperialyeast.com. Well, I have some sad news. I had to dump my goza that I was working on. My plan was to brew the beer and use the Lithuanian farmhouse yeast that Frederick in Denmark sent me to sour it. And then I was going to add salt and bottle. Well, I only added around 5 IBUs of hops in the boil, and I guess that was too much for the souring bugs in the mixed culture. So the beer fermented, but it didn't sour. And I thought I could resolve the situation by putting the plastic bucket fermenter into my high-gravity brewing system and by using a water bath to keep the beer at 110 degrees Fahrenheit while I pitched dregs from a previous batch that did sour. I was thinking that there wasn't enough lactobacillus in the yeast that I cropped from the first batch that I used in the second. Anyway, even after adding the dregs from the sour batch, the pH did not drop. Worse, after 3 days, the beer started to oxidize and darken. So it was with a heavy heart that I dumped the beer. I'll have to try again with kettle souring and no hops next time. But to be a little more practical, a little more traditional, quote-unquote. So you live and you learn. But the failed beer was no fault of my electric brewing system from our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. That brew-in-a-bag system is so versatile, and I put a picture of it on Twitter and Instagram. In the case for this beer, I added water into the system and put the fermenter bucket into it, setting the Warthog controller to 110 degrees Fahrenheit or 43°C in the mash mode. Then, I could literally walk away for days while the temperature was held rock steady in that fermenter. I wanted to encourage, the lactobacillus to get to work. And I have used this technique to sour beers successfully in the past, but in that case, I used glass carboys where I could fill them up to the top and, limit the amount of headspace over the wort and therefore limit the oxygen exposure so it wouldn't, oxidize. But one of the nice things about using the high-gravity system in this way is that you can do wort souring in the wintertime and keep the lactobacillus nice and warm and happy, even if the rest of your house is cold. It's the same principle as the yogurt setting on your Instant Pot, but with my high-gravity system, you can sour 5 gallons of wort instead of just a small amount of yogurt in the Instant Pot. Anyway, High Gravity has a variety of configurations of electric systems and Warthog controllers that you can just use to brew normal beer if you want to. If you don't do brew in a bag, you can move into 2 or 3 vessel systems from 5 gallons to 2 barrels. And the High Gravity crew uses an electric system for their Pippin's Tap Room brewing, along with a Warthog controller. So you know that they know what they're talking about. And the systems are robust. Check all of them out at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com and use the promo code EBC75BB to save $75 off your electric gear purchase. It's highgravitybrew.com. Okay, let's talk to Val Allen about how you can successfully make a delicious goza. Well, Val Allen, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Well, thank you. Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I enjoyed your book, and it inspired me to do an attempt on the style of my own, which we may talk about here in a few minutes. How long have you been associated with the style, and where did you pick up interest in it?
I had never heard of goza 5 years ago, and I don't think a lot of people had. And we were futzing around, our lab manager and myself. He has since moved on to run Seismic Brewery, good guy, Andy Hooper. We're just kind of messing around with the idea of doing a sour mash beer, which I'd tried before and had not been successful at. And Andy tried one, and results were undrinkable. And I said to him, well, what do you think we did wrong? And he said, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. And Andy's a really smart guy. And so, you know, I figured if Andy was going to find out, I better do some research on my own. And I better figure some things out that we could talk about. So we both did some research and came up with very similar conclusions that we could do a few things to improve the process. And we're sitting down talking about it at our pub one day. And a local homebrewer, a guy named Mike Lucarello, came in and sit down with us. And he said, oh, that sounds like an awesome way to make a goza. And both Andy and I said, a what? A goza? And he said, yeah. And so we went and did a bunch of reading. And thought, yeah, he's right. This does sound kind of like a cool way to make a goza, you know, brew house souring. And we thought, well, now we have a style guide, you know, goal. And we went out and bought a few gozas, so we knew a little bit better about what we were aiming for. And then we brewed one, and it turned out pretty good. We were lucky in that. And it kind of just went from there. We developed a beer that my boss thought, that he said, you know, this beer has legs. And I was like, really? You think sour and salty is going to go somewhere in the world of IPAs? And he said, oh, yeah. And, you know, sure enough, he was right. So the whole thing was very serendipitous. We didn't have a plan to brew a goza. I certainly didn't think that anybody would buy a sour, salty beer in America. And, you know, Mike Lucarello and the owner of the brewery, Trey White, they had vision. I lacked vision.
And goza is a style, according to your book, that has almost died two or three times in its long history. Talk a bit about that. Where did it come from?
Goza is a German style of wheat beer, and some people think there's a family of these sorts of wheat beers. Berliner Weiss and Belgian Wit might be included in them, Brohan, Lichtenhainer. Records are difficult back in the day. There weren't a lot of records kept. What were kept were often in Latin or some form of old German. And so it's really hard to know from those records exactly what was going on. But it looks like a town called Goslar came into existence about 1,100 years ago, maybe a little older. And people had been living in this area for several thousand years before that, but it wasn't really a town. There was certainly a place where people would stop. And when the town started to really grow up, they started to brew beer, obviously. I think if there are any more than about four people in a spot, one of them back then said, well, we should brew some beer. And a town rose up called Goslar, and it's a town in what we used to call Eastern Germany. It is kind of midway between Berlin and Leipzig. It's a little west of both of those towns. And they started making a beer, and there's a river that runs through Goslar called the Goza River, and they named the beer after the river, Goza. And it started to get accolades fairly early on. And that's how we knew it existed. People started talking about it. But we don't know a lot about it. Back in the day, really, there were two families of beers. There was a brown beer that was made with barley that was very alcoholic, probably spiced with gruit or some sort of spice mix. And then there were white beers or wheat beers, and they were made with wheat and they were lighter. Probably initially weren't sour, although maybe, but soon after they were brewed, the bacteria was part of the ferment and they were sour beers. And Goza comes out of that latter family, the lighter wheat beer that was sour. The towns around Goza started to imitate the beer. So they, you know, there are lots of references to different towns in between Leipzig and Goslar that made a goza. It was started to be imitated, and it became quite popular. And at one point, it was so popular in Hamburg which was the main export town for beer in Germany. It became so popular in Hamburg that they actually passed a taxation law on imported beers to kind of tamp down its popularity. And so it was huge for a while. It was a big export. There were dozens of breweries in Goslar making the beer. And the concept of brewery back then is slightly different than today. If you had a brewing license or, a license to make beer, you didn't necessarily have a physical brewery. A lot of the equipment was shared back then. You had the right to make beer, but you didn't necessarily have the equipment. So when I say dozens of breweries, it's kind of a different connotation. Dozens of people were, doing it. But then the beer kind of, for different reasons, wars and loss of supply route and taxation, the beer, kind of waned in popularity in Goslar, and it became popular in Leipzig. So it kind of almost died out completely in Goslar, but at the same time, it was gaining popularity in Leipzig, and it became quite popular there, and people started brewing it. And the beer changed over time some, I think, as this happened. Its popularity grew there, but not nowhere else. And then lagers started to become popular, and the Germans, very serious about their lagers. They even have a law about it, the Rheinheitsgebot. Eventually, in the early part of last century, they just couldn't compete anymore, and Goza production became smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually just died out. The First World War and the Second World War were not very kind to Goza, or Leipzig, and it completely vanished for a short time. After World War II, communists took over that part of Germany. Any, Goza that was left was crushed out of existence by the East German government. The communist government had no interest in supporting local kind of niche products like that, and they were, wanted to make a much more consolidated culture. So Goza disappeared completely. And then a guy came on the scene. His name is Lothar Goldhahn. He decided, he had a background and a degree in running hotels and restaurants, and he decided that he wanted to open a restaurant. And he decided the Goza Schanken, Goza Schanken, Onobedenken, was what he wanted to reopen. And it was had been a very famous Goza tavern. And he bought the property and, went to the government to ask. And they said, well, you're connected with our party and, you have a few inns. We'll help you out a little bit, but you have to put in about 3,000 hours of your own work. And he revamped this tavern, and each day or so, he would go out and try and find more information about Goza and find memorabilia from Leipzig's past, or Goza's, past. And he started collecting things. And one day at a flea market, he met a guy, Herr Hennebach, and he became friends. And he invited Hennebach to come help him out with his project. And he, the guy was selling stuff at a flea market. The economy in Leipzig wasn't really booming in the 80s. And he agreed, and they got together and opened it. And, Goldhahn had his idea was to make an authentic Goza. And so he found a brewery that would do it for him, and he did a bunch of research. And he got a bunch of guys together who were old enough to have, drank Goza back in the day. And he brought his new version of Goza to them. He did research and found recipes, and they tried it and they said, well, yeah, this is actually better than the old Goza. And so he's like, well, now we have a beer, we have a brewery who will make it for us. And they were off to the races, and it became quite popular again, and it actually became so popular that he was able to expand out the business. And for a while, you couldn't even get a seat at the bar or in the beer garden. Germans are very big on their beer gardens. And then when the wall came down, his success continued. And he had to shift around, a couple times to find other breweries to make his beer, because Goza is not the simplest beer to make. And I think it frightened a lot of lager brewers. When he passed away, Hennebach took over, and he became the champion of Goza. And for decades, they, ran the Onabedenken, which is still there, still operating. And Dr. Hennebach passed away a few years ago. He didn't live to see the revival of Goza. I'm sure he would have been thrilled to see his beer, which he nurtured for so long, make this transition from being a kind of niche beer from Saxony now into, really a global brand of beer. And the people who took over the Onabedenka are still running it, really great people. They bought a little brewery a couple of years ago, and now are making their own beer there. It's kind of a fantastic success story.
And you describe sort of three eras of Goza throughout history, and the way that they might have been, the character of those three types of Goza throughout time. But what, if you were to describe Goza to someone now as what is, sort of the idealized version of the style, what would it be?
Well, I think today's Goza is, depending on, which Goza you have, the American brewers a little want to make things a little crazy and different. So if you're talking about just your straight Goza, like our Holy Goza that we make at Anderson Valley, or the Goza served at Onabedenken, or, other people's Westbrook's regular Goza, I think you would describe it as, a sour wheat beer with has a mild sourness, crisp and very clean, and it has a slightly minerally or saline quality. I wouldn't say it was salty in any way, but saline maybe. And it's, sprightly and refreshing and has a lot of wheat character.
Where does this, you don't think of, necessarily putting salt or, into a beer or a beer having a saline quality. Where did that come from? Where did that originate?
Well, that's a good question, and we can't answer that for sure, but I postulate a few theories in the book, and, when I was very fortunate when I went to do my research in Germany, I ran into a guy, and his name's Benedict, and he was kind of obsessed with Goza, and I just kind of found him online, and I flew into Berlin, and he was getting into Berlin on the same day to go visit some friends, so he took me with them, and they have a brewery there, a little brewery, and they make Berliner Weiss, a traditional Berliner Weiss, and they're one of the few small breweries that are still doing it, and we got to discussing different things, and Benedict was very helpful, and because he's German and he reads German, speaks German way better than I do, so he was able to translate some of the older texts for me. And he said, "Well, you're going to Goslar, right?" I said, "Oh yeah." He said, "When you get there, taste the water in the river, and tell me what you think." I said, "Okay," because my assumption had been that the Goza River ran through an area where they did a lot of mining and picked up a lot of mineral content. But I got there and I hiked out of town so I could get, some fresh water from the river and tasted it. And it was not saline or minerally particularly. A little bit minerally, but definitely not saline. So, it could be that the water was different 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years is a long time. Maybe the river tasted different back then. But I don't think so. That's not the kind of thing that changes that dramatically over time.
Mm-hmm.
So the region that it's in is called the Harz, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing everything German here, but that region had salt mining in it. And, you know, salt was a very valuable commodity back in the day. Some places would not be able to put salt in beer. But in that region where it was so plentiful, it was certainly affordable enough to put into beer. And, you know, I don't know if you've seen people put salt in their beer. It's kind of a thing I've seen in some of the Northwest areas, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado. You know, I'll see sometimes people put salt in their beer, and it gives the beer kind of a fullness. And I found records talking about brewers putting salt in their beer, not necessarily Goza, but in other beers to give it fullness. So I suspect that at some point in Goslar's history, their brewers started using salt, putting a little salt in the beer to give it a little more fullness, maybe give it a unique character. And it was plentiful in that area and not expensive, and so they could do it. And when people tried to emulate the Gosa style in nearby towns, they did the same thing to achieve, you know, a little more fullness in the beer. That's my guess.
So we're talking to homebrewers here. So, you know, everybody wants to formulate a good recipe. So talk about how much salt, you know, you would put in a 5-gallon batch.
Oh, my God, I can't. I'd have to get a reference to there. I don't know, not much. In the book, I talk about how much, you know, salt you should use. And I think, you know, the important point here is that you're hoping to achieve a mild salinity or mineral note. You definitely don't want to make the beer salty. So you definitely don't want to use like a handful of salt in a 5-gallon batch. If you give me a second, I do have one of the books here. I can just take a look.
Yeah, I'm looking here at the Sequench Sour from Dogfish Head. They call
those guys.
What do they know?
What do those guys know about beer?
They call for about half an ounce or 15 grams. It seems like to me that it ranges, like, for instance, the strong English Goza from Gordon Strong, he puts about a third of an ounce or 10 grams of kosher salt.
Well,
and again, what does he know? But
yeah, Gordon, for God's sake, he only knows everything.
You know, so it ranges, you know, I guess, you know, there's another one from Tiny Bubbles from Eric Rose of Hollister Brewing Company. He puts in 0.21 ounces or, you know, 5.9 grams. So we're not. So, yeah, you're not talking about a huge handful of salt there, but just enough to give it just a hint, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I think all the recipes in the back, you know, I went through them and made sure that they were kind of relatively even handed. I think most of those are excellent brewers, the people who sent in recipes and participated in the book. And so, yeah, you don't want a lot of salt. You just want a little bit. And you just want a kind of a pinch in there, and that'll give you some nice saline quality.
And what about the grain bill?
The grain bill, you know, it's a wheat beer, so you definitely need some wheat. Some people use up to 60%, and there's definitely records in history about people using 100% wheat, but if you're a home brewer or a brewer, you know that 100% wheat is going to be problematic. So the grain bill today and through most of last century was probably very close to 50-50 wheat and barley. Talk some about air drying malt, which is, you know, was a thing back in history. And you can air dry both your barley or your wheat malt, giving it different flavors than you would have had, than you would have from normal malt today.
Yeah, and you said that air drying instead of, you know, drying by heat gives the grain sort of a more raw character?
Yeah, it's raw, grassy, clover, hay, you know. Flavors are hard to describe, but it certainly is not the roasty, biscuity, you know, bready flavors that we associate with malt today. I'd never heard of air drying malt, and every maltster that I contacted had never heard of air drying malt. So, but there's, you know, there's ample discussion of it in the historical record. So I went to a friend of mine who grows some wheat on his property and got enough to try an experiment. And I malted it myself, which I had never done before, so it was kind of cool to do. And then I air dried it, and sure enough, the flavors that most maltsters had described that were probably going to, come out of the experiment were what I got. I think a lot of maltsters taste the malt along the way, and the kind of the universal thing was like, well, you can do it, but here are the reasons you don't want to do it. Hmm. Here's the problems you're going to have. And, it doesn't store well. So, once it's, I suppose there should be air quotes around dried, because it's not as dry as a kilned malt ever. It's got so much moisture that eventually it's gonna mold. So if you're making air dried malt, you need to use it within a few days, or certainly within a few weeks. You can't store it over winter. It doesn't have any biscuity flavor. It's very kind of like raw and green and grassy. But the beer that I made from it was very interesting. And again, one of the things that I talk about in the book is how different brewing is today than it was, 500 years ago or 800 years ago. The equipment was certainly almost all wood. They didn't have any instruments for measuring anything. They didn't have a thermometer. They didn't have a hydrometer. They certainly didn't have a densiometer. They couldn't take a pH reading. So it was all kind of, by the seat of their pants, and they didn't understand the action that yeast played, the part that yeast played in it, or bacteria played in the fermentation. Probably they didn't even pitch yeast. And if they did, they didn't, fully understand what they were doing by repitching the stuff at the bottom of the wooden vessel. Probably the fermentation happened rather spontaneously from the critters, the yeast and bacteria that were, living in the wood.
And these beers would probably evolve over time. I mean, each batch would, after it was freshly brewed, it would have one character, and then over time it would develop into a completely different beer.
Yeah, absolutely. I was very fortunate to work for Merchant Devin back in the day, and Charles and Roseanne Finkel, who own it, would often, not often, but occasionally, take me with them on trips. And one time we went out to England, and we were visiting the Samuel Smith Brewery, and I was lucky enough to have a discussion with Humphrey Smith, who owns Samuel Smith, and he's quite an eccentric character. And he'd bought an older brewery in a nearby town. And it was, it was one of these steam-driven wooden breweries. Everything was wood, and everything was run by this giant steam engine, and the fermenters were wood. And I was a young brewer, and I said to him, wow, what was the beer like that, that was coming out of this brewery when you bought it? And he said, oh, it was wildly inconsistent. And this is a brewery that had run up into like the 1970s, and so when you talk about the beer changed, I think that if we'd been alive 500 years, 600 years ago, beer would barely be recognizable to us. Mm. It would be this beverage that was never achieved any sort of clarity, probably because it never got cold. It was probably served relatively fresh, lest it get sour. Like I said earlier, there were two types of beers. There were big, heavy, strong brown beers that were made with spices, and those beers were sweet and alcoholic. And then there were the lighter, the wheat beers, which, most certainly didn't have any legs to age for any length of time without getting sour. Everything around you was, dried or heated or cooked with wood. So everything was smoky. People bathed infrequently at best. And so not only was the beer sour, but your neighbor sitting at the bar was sour smelling. I just, there were no thermometers. everything was wooden and smoky and sour. And I think that we would have a hard time, you know, getting on board with some of the flavors that we would find in our local tavern 600 years ago.
Yeah, you talked about the local innkeeper or the barkeeper, you know, kind of judging the patrons by their experience with Goza and, you know, either giving them a younger one or an older one, depending on, you know, their perceived preference for the beer.
Yeah, I think that you gotta keep in mind perceived preference is kind of maybe a polite term. I think if they had Goza that was going off, getting a little more acidic, a little more vinegary than they liked, there were some patrons who liked that, so they knew those people and served them that. But I think that if you're a visitor from outside of Leipzig, you know, young kid showing up, they may have served that to you too because they were trying to, you know, just get it out of there as fast as they could before it became complete vinegar.
So nowadays we have more modern techniques for achieving a delicious and tasty sour component. You talk about souring, you know, pre and post fermentation. Kettle souring nowadays, even yesterday, I saw some comment on Twitter where someone was, disrespecting, you know, kettle souring as, you know, something less than, souring that's done over time in a barrel or something like that. So I take it that you think that kettle souring for a Goza is a legitimate, and sound practice.
Yeah, you know, I don't think you can use it for everything, and certainly it produces a different kind of beer than souring in a barrel. But the people that are poo-pooing it either don't understand the process or are trying to make just the point I made that it's very different and you shouldn't try and pass off like a barrel-aged sour beer that you brewhouse soured a week ago. They're just very different processes. I don't think one is necessarily better than the other. Better is, you know, very subjective. I would say that kettle souring is a technique that makes a very clean and bright and manageable sourness, but it's not going to have the depth or complexity that you would find from a beer that you made in another method. I don't think one's better than the other. I just think you have to be honest with yourself and your customers about what you're doing and what you're hoping to achieve. You know, you're not going to get a whole lot of funk in a beer that is kettle soured or brewhouse soured. And if you're hoping to make a super clean, you know, or a clean, bright Goza, you're not going to really achieve that by trying to do it in a wooden barrel, you know, out in your barn. If you want more funk, There are ways to achieve that in the brewhouse souring, but you know that has its own limitations, and even then it's not going to be as complex or have the same depth that you'd get from barrel souring it.
So, what's your target pH when you brew a Goza?
Again, that depends on what you hope to achieve. Our target, pH at Anderson Valley is somewhere in the low threes, 3.2, 3.3. And then there's some discussion in the book about the difference between pH and TA. So those are two different kind of measurements of the amount of acid. pH is a much easier one to read, so that's kind of what we talk about mostly as brewers. But we try and also get, but the quality of the sourness to be where we want.
And you're talking about a lactic sourness that is nice and clean and tart, not acidic as far as being like a vinegary character, which to me kettle souring would be perfect for, right?
Absolutely. If you're ending up with acetic acid in your kettle or brewhouse souring, then you may have some real problems. The brewhouse souring, I talk about this a lot in the book, all the kind of different methods that people are doing and the different ways you can go about achieving it. But it's fairly straightforward, easy enough to do thing. you know, you mash in like a normal beer, and then you run off in the kettle. You get your wort off your grain because there's a whole bunch of bacteria in there that you don't want. And there's also oxygen in there that is entrapped by the grain bed, and you don't want oxygen in the process. So, yeah, you don't want the oxygen in there. So you run off of the grain and get it into the kettle, and then you pitch in some lactic acid bacteria, and there are many different methods for achieving that. Some people use a bag of grain, and other people grow it up on their own. Grain is covered with lactic acid bacteria, so that's a good source, or can be a good source. Some people put yogurt. They use yogurt to get their lactic acid bacteria. That's fairly common. Or some people just order lactic acid bacteria from their local yeast supplier, and that's certainly the cleanest way to do it, but it's also probably the most expensive way to do it. So, you know, it depends on what you're hoping to achieve. But once you get that lactic acid bacteria in there, if you get the proper amount, you should be able to sour that entire batch with a nice clean lactic acid flavor in anywhere from 8 to 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a little bit of an extra step, but it's not like, you know, when you barrel age something and you're hoping to achieve some sourness in a barrel aged beer, you know, the fastest you're going to do it is about 6 months. And anybody who's doing that kind of aging knows that it can take, you know, anywhere from 6 months to 4 years. We have a beer that we make that takes about 4 years to get into the kind of shape we want.
Hmm.
And so, you know, barrel aging, I think if you talk to anybody who's been doing it for any length of time, who's at least honest, will tell you it's super complicated. They probably don't even know what's going on in each of those barrels. In fact, they know they don't. You talk to Vinny Chilerzo or Tommy Arthur, who are probably two of the best at it, and they say that, you know, these beers kind of make themselves, and the brewer's art is blending.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go through and you taste all your barrels and you decide which ones have, you know, done the things you wanted and which ones haven't. And you, you know, exclude those ones that haven't, and you either put them back in the barn and hope that they, you know, come around, or, you know, if they've gone to vinegar, you put them on your fish and chips or dump them. It can be very, very tricky. And, you know, we learned that the amount of hops you put in can have a great effect on the bacteria. And, you know, sometimes you don't think about that. You think, oh, well, you know, if I leave a beer out, it'll sour eventually. But with beers that you hop with any, you know, sort of IBUs in it, and as little as 5 IBUs can affect this, that some of these beers don't want to sour.
Mm.
Some of them will probably never sour. You know, you have to put a big hoppy IPA into a barrel thinking, you know, well, it'll just go. It may not. You may wait years. So, yeah, hopping is important, and the type of bacteria you use is important. Some lactobacillus are more hop tolerant than others. I talk about that some in the book. There's a great, great site called Milk the Funk.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with these guys.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Love that site. Those guys, I stumbled on them while doing research for the book, and got sucked into this rabbit hole that I thought at one point I felt like I was, you know, being sucked under by some sort of, you know, big, hairy, infected monster. I just thought I'd never get out of, because it was so interesting. I kept reading and linking to another article, and I'm like, oh my God, these people, they are so amazing. We got really smart people doing really interesting research that I don't think people have done before, and certainly they haven't documented it in quite this way. So any of your listeners out there, Milk the Funk, they got a Facebook page and a wiki page, and it's just filled with fascinating, interesting, way out there brewing stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an excellent resource. One thing that we didn't talk about is spices. Where do spices come into the goza?
Yeah, you know, Benedict and I discussed this some, and I think Benedict's of a different opinion than I am about spices. And the whole question of spices is a very interesting one. If you do any reading on Gruet, I don't think that there's any really conclusive. I don't think anybody really knows exactly what Gruet was, because there's some discussion about Gruet being spices, and then there's some discussion about Gruet being the yeast slurry, and Gruet certainly at some point in time was a spice mixture that people used in brewing, particularly brown beers, but probably all beers. Gruet rights were owned by the king, and there was an edict that all beer must have Gruet in it, and so I don't think that a whole lot of people would violate that that rule. And Gruet was the way for the monarch to tax people, and oftentimes brewers would pick up their malt from a location where the Gruet was already mixed into it. So definitely there were spices in beers, and there's lots of documentation of the spices that were used and you know what kind they were. So all beer at some point in the past, I believe, was probably spiced. And hops were not part of that spice mixture at first. And later hops came into vogue, and there are a lot of reasons for this. Some people have made, you know, postulated that there's a conspiracy theory and nefarious reason for using hops because they're a sedative, and they didn't like the more aphrodisiac effects that Gruet probably they postulate they say it had. I don't find a lot of evidence for that. I think that the main reason that people made a switch from using spices to hops is because they were economic reasons. Hops preserves the beer way better than alcohol or other spices do. They keep lactic acid bacteria and other bacteria from growing in your beer. And there's a couple different passages in different books that talk about the reason the brewers have switched from using Gruet to hops is because you can make beers that are a quarter as strong, because alcohol was the main thing that kept beer from going sour back in, you know, several hundred years ago. And then they started using hops, and like, oh my God, I don't have to use 40 pounds of malt per gallon. I can use 10. And, you know, it's just simple economics. They're like, I can make this drinkable product. You know, I can sell more of it because people that are drinking my beer, instead of having, you know, two and passing out, they can have, you know, four of them. And, you know, hops made a cleaner, better tasting beer that was less alcoholic and traveled better and lasted longer. And I think that, you know, how much more reason do you need to start using something? It's a win. And so, you know, hops became, they got used, and the spices got phased out for most beers. And, you know, and there's a few examples of beers that have survived that use spices in them. And, you know, Belgian wit beer is one of them. There's some other regional beers, but by and large, people don't use a whole lot of spices in beer. And they certainly didn't through most of the last century. Goza is an exception to that. And Goza, coriander somehow got to be the one spice that people used. And there's some pretty good literature about people using spruce as well in their goza several hundred years back. But coriander seemed to be the one that kind of won out. And it was probably part of a spice mixture that was used back when people were using Gruet. And why it stuck and others didn't, I don't know. But it is the common spice in goza.
It does seem to pair really well with the tartness and the wheat character of the beer, though.
Yeah, and that's probably why it stuck. And you know, Gose's are lowly hopped beers, and they use just enough to kind of give it some antimicrobial character. But if you use too much, and you're doing, you know, post-fermentation souring, that's going to affect your souring process. I think if you're doing a kettle souring, you don't need to worry about that as much. You can use more hops. But, you know, hops and coriander are kind of the ones that have won out. And I think you're correct that coriander is kind of a lemony note that goes very nicely, has a nice herbal flavor that goes, I think, quite well with a sour wheat beer. So it makes sense that it's the one that they still use.
And of course, the maybe one of the more, if not the most important component in beer is yeast. So I'm assuming that if you, especially if you're doing a kettle souring, you want a clean fermentation, a clean yeast.
There is some discussion about different yeasts used and the flavors of Gose's. People didn't talk a whole lot about the flavors of beer 500 or 600 years ago, so it's harder for us to know. Most of the records talk about the amount of malt used or you know, some of the brewing processes, but not a whole lot of descriptions of flavors. So when we start to see some of the descriptions of flavors, we can make some assumptions about the kinds of things they were using. And if they were using some crazy, very phenolic or, you know, bubblegummy German wheat beer yeast, I think that would have, you know, been reflected in the notes about flavor, but they're not. That's not how Gose is described. It's often, you know, described with the wheat character coming through a lot more. And milder yeast component flavors. So I think your best bet is to use a nice ale yeast, not one that's going to produce too many unusual or strong characters.
Well, very nice. We could talk probably for another hour on the topic.
Well.
It's a for such a simple beer, there's, you know, a lot of different strategies to achieve it. It's a good read. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I enjoyed writing it, and one of the things that I think that make this style, or you know, this book about this style, a little more interesting is that, as you said, there's so many components that go into making the beer. It's a very relatively simple beer on the one hand, but you know, there's a lot to talk about. There's, you know, brew house souring versus post-fermentation souring, and yeast and bacteria and pH, and there's just so many nuances to the beer that I think it's an interesting read for that reason. And the history of Goza is kind of really the history of beer. You go through the changes from using, you know, spices or gruit mixes to using hops to the changes that, you know, lagering brought about in the brewing industry. And it's interesting to think about what other beers we have missed that have died out because of the rise of the lager.
Well, and thanks to homebrewers largely, we are sort of rediscovering a lot of those that are coming back, and perhaps those will be a subject of a future book.
Yeah. No, not by me. I'm never writing another book ever because there's so much work. Brutally bashing to my ego when we went through the first technical edit, I was like, "Killing me here." No, it was a very good, it was a good process. I enjoyed doing it, and you know, maybe I'll have enough time to do another one when I retire.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate the conversation. It was fun.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thanks again to Fal. I'm going to try again to brew a Goza. Next time, I'm going to follow a more predictable route, like those described in Fal's Goza book. I'm not going to wing it next time with, you know, yeast that I got from a friend in Denmark. The yeast did work for another beer that you will see in an upcoming Basic Brewing video. But, you know, next time, I'm not going to risk dumping another Goza beer. I'm gonna follow the rules in the book. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies are coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can find our logbooks where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all that out at basicbrewingshop.com. Also, don't forget our silicone pints. That's all until next time. Till then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.